Hi, I'm Mark Brody, and this is the Friday Newscap podcast from KJZZ's The Show. Each Friday, we review the biggest and most important political stories of the week with a panel of experts, which puts those stories into perspective to help us understand why they matter. Here's this week's episode.
This budget focuses on what matters most to Arizona families: higher take-home pay, lower costs, protecting core services, and a responsible plan for state spending.
This bill would defund affordable housing in the state of Arizona at a time of record-breaking evictions and at a time when Arizona has unfortunately become one of the most expensive places in the country to live.
I oppose this motion to adjourn because as of now, we have not done enough for the Arizonans we were sent here to serve. We haven't done enough to build an Arizona we can afford yet.
We're going to do everything that we can to help those voters in Pinal County. But unfortunately, for now, the politics have won in the court, and we're going to try to figure out what's next.
So what's going to happen in places like New York? You know, people want to pass this ridiculous legislation not to work with us. We're going to flood the zone. You're going to see more ICE agents you've ever seen before.
I feel very comfortable saying that Howard Lutnick is a pathological liar who is enabling the most egregious cover-up in American history.
And joining me to talk about what's next for the state budget after the governor vetoed a GOP plan, a controversial congressional endorsement, and more are Matthew Benson of Veritas. Matt, good morning.
Good morning.
And Sam Richard of Consilium Consulting. Sam, good morning to you.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Good to have you guys both here. So, Sam, let me start with you on this first congressional district. This is the East Valley district that David Schweikert is. He currently holds a seat. He's leaving it to, of course, run for governor. The DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, whose job it is to elect Democrats to the U.S. House of Representatives this week, threw its support behind Marlene Galland Woods, who is running in a contested primary against, among others, Amish Shah. Why would a national organization sort of try to tip the scales in a contested primary like this?
I think there are a variety of reasons why, and I think many of them are legitimate. Some of them are not. I mean, I think that both of those kind of top-tier candidates in the race ran last cycle, and I think that there was, you know, a lot of lessons learned from both camps. But I think one of the overarching lessons is that Dr. Shah has always been an independent despite his allegiance to the Democratic Party. So, you know, the D-Trip is very much a, you know, an institution and you know, a longstanding organization that kind of requires allegiance to the party. And that's never been Dr. Shah's thing. So I think while you kind of look at this as maybe a negative for his campaign, I think it actually serves him quite well because all of the polling that I've seen so far shows that he's going to run away with it. But I think, you know, what's interesting about our focus on that primary is that, you know, the Republican primary is focusing on who's less of a Democrat or more of a Democrat in that. So it's really just a, you know, an early Democratic general election, you know, after Congressman Schweikert left the seat to run for governor. So it's a wide open race, and I think whoever comes out of the Democratic primary is the clear favorite. And I think the D-Trip is, you know, looking at somebody who might, you know, be easier to play nice with in the general election. And I think that voters are going to respond to that however they respond to that.
And the Republican side, to Sam's point, had a debate this week. But I wonder, like, Sam, you mentioned, you know, if she gets through the primary, the DCCC might have an easier time sort of working with her than somebody else. Does this help her get through the primary?
I think it's definitely an important thing, but I think right now she's working from behind in the primary right now, both from a name ID. I mean, Dr. Shah won the Democratic nomination for Congressional District 1 2 years ago. He's very well known. He has incredible name ID. He's a prolific fundraiser. He's a prolific campaigner. I think he's knocked on every door at least 3 times in any district he's ever run. So I think that perhaps maybe the D-Trip was looking at a way to try to make it a bit more competitive because maybe they didn't want Dr. Shah to run away with it and maybe hedge against, you know, the potential that Marlene wins the primary. But I think right now, sitting on, you know, May 8th, I would be surprised if Dr. Shah is not the nominee heading into the general election.
So, Matt, Sam mentioned that this might actually help Amish Shah in some ways. He, after this announcement came out, he put out a statement of his own criticizing what he called Washington elites for, you know, trying to tip the, you know, put their thumb on the scale in this race. Do you think this could potentially help Shaw in this primary?
I don't know that it helps him. I mean, look, the impact of the decision by the DCCC is to put more money behind Woods. And so that certainly is theoretically a boost to her. But let's just call it what it is. It's a miscalculation on the DCCC's part. They don't know CD1. This is a right-of-center district with a long history of electing Republicans, including its current Congressman David Schweikert. It is a swing district. It is in play, no question. But the strongest candidate the Democrats could put forward is somebody like Shaw, who is sort of a independent, you know, has that independent streak about him. So, you know, the idea that they're going to instead back the other candidate who's further left, more progressive, quote unquote, whatever, I think maybe that helps in a primary, but it doesn't help in a general election, which is what this is all about.
Well, and Matt, to your point, this is one of those districts that across the country, national Democrats are really looking at that if they want to flip the House, this seems to be one that they would maybe not need, but really, really like to have.
No, they need it.
You think they actually need this district?
Yes. And I mean, look, we just saw today the Virginia Supreme Court overturned the redistricting out there. So those five seats, I think it was, will instead of being Democrat, you know, aligned seats, they will be strongly Republican seats. So if Democrats want to take the House, I think CD1 becomes increasingly important to them now. And outside of, you know, Sicamani's district down in Tucson, this is the most in-play district in the state.
Sam, let's say for a minute that Shaw is the nominee again. Does it matter at that point in the general election that the DCCC backed one of his opponents and not him?
No. I think that, you know, one of the organizing principles that I've always lived by is no permanent friends, no permanent enemies. And I think that, you know, come July 22nd, the day after the primary, everyone's going to dust themselves off and they'll have a clarion call to see what happens in early November. And the DTRIP will support whoever emerges from the Democratic primary.
Okay. Guys, let's move on to the state capitol this week, because after it seems like on Monday, we're not going to be able to talk about the state capitol much for a little while because the legislature is going to be taking a little bit of a break. The Senate, as expected, approved the budget that the House had approved the prior week. Again, as expected, Governor Hobbs vetoed it. Matt, is this just setting it up for the actual real negotiations to start?
Well, everything has to fall apart before it can come together. We see this every session. So I think the real question is how motivated legislators are to try to get a deal quickly with the governor. And, you know, what you've seen this week is not just the veto, but then you saw both the House and Senate. You know, the House is out until June 1. The Senate is going to come back on Monday, and then they'll adjourn until June 1. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be a period of weeks here, 3+ weeks, where there's really nothing happening at the Capitol outside of some budget talks. So who's going to blink? You know, that's really the question here. And there are huge political implications, obviously.
Does it matter that – so obviously, you know, legislators, those who are running for re-election or running for something else, the primary, to Sam's point, is coming up not that long from now. Does it help them that they now have a few weeks to sort of be out in their districts, meeting constituents, knocking on doors? They obviously can't take money from lobbyists because the session is still in session. But does this help them maybe, and then they come back and finish up what they need to do? And then, because they're probably not going to have a lot of time from the time they finish the session to when people start voting.
I think their preference would be to just get the budget done and be done with the session and get out there on the campaign trail full time and be able to raise money from everybody, including lobbyists, mm-hmm. and, you know, do their thing. The advantage is really with the governor, who, you know, like my old boss, Governor Brewer, liked to say, I'm here year round. So, yeah. You know, the time is really on her side.
And I would say, you know, we're sitting in here in studio as political insiders talking about how this was, you know, a quote unquote, you know, performative budget that we knew was going to fall apart before we get to the real thing. But there was a real vote on a budget that was bad for families, bad for the economy, and bad for public safety. And really, frankly, it was only good for Andy Biggs in his campaign for governor. And these were real votes that, that the members of the legislature have to go back to their district and talk about why they supported a cut for Sunbucks, which feeds 600,000 of our neighbors who rely on these food programs during the summer, or things like a complete cut, no new money for the Department of Forestry and Fire Management while the Hazen fire burns at 10% containment. So I think that, that you know, these folks who are going to also be on the ballot have to go back to their neighbors, back to their districts, and try to run for reelection and justify a vote for a budget that did not move Arizona forward in any way, just to be able to get to a point to actually have a negotiation with the adults in the room is going to be something that I think will have disastrous political consequences for the folks who chose to vote for this.
Sam, what do you think are the biggest stumbling blocks for each side? Like, what are the issues that the governor and legislative Republicans are going to be sort of the hardest to move on?
I think that what it really comes down to is whether or not folks on either side of the political spectrum are willing to publicly embrace the reality of the fiscal picture that we have in Arizona. As a result of President Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill, we have a huge bill coming due to the taxpayers of Arizona in conformity to some of these programs, the strict requirements of some of the public programs that, that provide resources to our neighbors. And I also think just the you know, $6.50 gas because of the conflict in Iran. I think that those are the realities. Our economy is thriving in some ways, but from a fiscal picture for the state's finances, we're facing some serious questions and some serious dollars. So right now we have partisan conversations that led us to where we're at now. So hopefully now that we can have serious conversations with reality and real numbers in black and white on the paper. And I think that will serve the discussion moving forward for the next couple of weeks.
Matt, what about you? What do you think are going to be the biggest sort of hurdles to overcome here?
Well, I think the there are two main issues, right? The governor would prefer to maintain spending as much as possible and to have smaller tax cuts. And the Republicans are pushing for larger tax cuts. In fact, the proposal legislators put forward was almost $1.5 billion worth of tax cuts. So that's really the centerpiece of the legislative budget. And they'd like to have larger program cuts in order to help pay for some of those, the tax reductions. And then Prop 123, which we haven't talked about yet, and the renewal of K-12 funding, that's about $300 million a year that is still sort of hanging out there. I think, look, it's all sort of a tangled mess, and you have to – that is going to be the key to getting a budget deal. And is there a way to somehow get Prop 123 money into the budget, get tax cuts, and use some of this to help reduce program cuts? I think that's probably where you end up finding a budget. It's going to have to be a cobbled together coalition once again. Obviously, we have divided government.
Right.
I suspect that this earlier budget that got vetoed, and by the way, that may not be the only budget that gets vetoed before we actually get a deal. I don't suspect that's going to matter much. I think what will count is the final product, and we don't know what that's going to be.
Is there a risk with Prop 123? Or maybe you have to build in a contingency, because obviously that has to go back to the voters. So, you know, you can build in, okay, we're going to assume that this gets passed and we don't have to spend $300 million on schools again. But I wonder, Matt, is there a bit of a risk in doing that? Because the voters could say no.
Well, of course. Yeah, there's absolutely a risk there. And there's also a risk to Republicans in putting renewal on the budget, which may help, you know, drive out theoretically you know, K-12 voters, red for red voters, that sort of thing. So all of these things are all part of the calculation that folks are weighing.
Sam, gubernatorial candidate Hugh Lytle, who's running on now the No Labels Party banner, won a court ruling this week allowing him to stay on the ballot. So he will be in the race for governor. The conventional wisdom, rightly or wrongly, has been that his candidacy is less good for Governor Hobbs than it is for Andy Biggs, thinking that he might draw more votes from Hobbs than Biggs. I'm wondering what kind of impact you think his candidacy might have.
Absolutely nothing.
Really?
I have full faith and confidence in our five-star recruit in Governor Hobbs, who's had a significant track record in her first term, who is already leading in the polls 6 months before people receive their ballots at home. You know, Mr. Lytle was a former walk-on to ASU to play in the football program, and he's clearly walking on here into the political spectrum. Nobody's clamoring for the platform that he's bringing to the race, and I think that it's fairly well defined. Even though there will be other names on the ballot, it really is going to be Governor Hobbs versus Congressman Biggs. And right now, it looks like it's going to be a double-digit victory for Governor Hobbs. I think that will only increase.
So you think even in a race where last time Governor Hobbs won by, what, 17,000 votes, having a third-party candidate with a lot of money behind him, you think won't matter?
I don't think it's a lot of money in relative terms. I mean, Governor Hobbs herself, as well as the outside support from the Democratic Governors Association and other outside groups, are going to dwarf whatever money comes in from Mr. Lytle. And I just I understand that, you know, I might be a bit Pollyannish, or at least the accusation might come from my friend Matt over here that I'm Pollyannish about this, but. You know, Governor Hobbs has not ever lost an election, and I don't think she's going to start now.
Matt, do you think Sam's being Pollyannish?
Look, I'm just my jaw hit the ground when he said double-digit victory. I mean, look, anything is possible, but this is still a state where Republicans outnumber Democrats by like 300,000. So, I think any objective observer would say the incumbent has the advantage right now, but I mean, it's May 8th, so it's early. A lot can happen. And back to our friend Hugh Lytle, he doesn't have to be a significant player in this race to have a determinative effect on the race, okay? He can play spoiler even if he only gets 5%, 3%. I mean, Mark, you mentioned how close that election was in 2022 when Governor Hobbs was elected. I mean, if Lytle gets just a few points of people, a protest vote, if you want to call it that. I mean, that could be determinative.
Do you buy into the conventional wisdom that he's more likely to draw votes from Governor Hobbs than Congressman Biggs?
I do, simply because he seems to be positioning himself in that way. So to more of a left-leaning audience. And so, you know, the question is going to be when he starts spending real money, what do those ads look like? But I would really be surprised if he's drawing a significant faction of conservative or Republican voters.
Sam, would you expect Governor Hobbs to, in her campaigning, to try to address his candidacy in some way, to either draw distinctions or, you know, mention him in some way, to try to head off the possibility that some even moderate Republican votes who might have voted for her in the past might now go to Hugh Lytle?
Yeah, I don't foresee the governor herself or even the campaign addressing Lytle either directly or indirectly. I think that a lot of the outside groups, the allies, the surrogates, they might, you know, take a crack at
some
that.
Of the PACs,
yeah,
and things like
but,
that.
But I mean, you know, Governor Hobbs is, you know, running a state right now in addition to running a campaign. And I don't think that she is going to be focused on someone who is new to the political scene and, you know, really is just being there to play spoiler. It's a, you know, a philosophical Hail Mary from, you know, someone who really isn't even looking to win. And I think that you know, that doesn't deserve a lot of attention from the incumbent, who is well on pace to see victory in
November.
Look,
there are only two names that Governor Hobbs is going to reference in this campaign, and those two names are Andy Biggs and Donald Trump.
That's right. Okay?
She is not going to talk about Hugh Lytle.
Interesting. All right. So, guys, we saw this week a decision, not a ruling, obviously. She's not a judge, but a decision from Attorney General Chris Mays. She had been asked by some Republican state legislators to look into whether an ordinance in Pima County violated state law. This basically says that ICE can't use county resources or county property. They can't stage operations in some ways in Pima County. Matt, Mays said that ordinance is okay. It does not run afoul of state law. Republicans in the legislature not thrilled about this. Is it So I guess what do you make of her decision and maybe the response to it?
Well, I think it's interesting in terms of the precedent it potentially sets, because we also have cities, City of Phoenix, City of Tucson as well, I believe, that have their own ordinances saying ICE cannot utilize city property or city parks to stage immigration enforcement operations. So this seems to sort of clear the way for all of that. Now, it may still be subject to court action if somebody decides to challenge it. And then I think the real question is, push come to shove, if the feds come in and decide they're going to stage on city or county property, who's going to stop it and in what way? I have a hard time believing you're going to see sheriff's deputies or city police squaring off with ICE agents on public property.
Well, and Sam, to Matt's point, we heard at the beginning of this segment that Tom Homan, the president's border czar at the Border Security Expo this week, basically said, look, if you're in a place that is not cooperating with ICE, we're just going to send a ton of ICE agents in there.
Yeah. You know, that kind of deeply partisan rhetoric or bombastic rhetoric from Mr. Homan is interesting. But I just think that, you know, the facts of this issue are that Arizona does not have sanctuary cities. That is absolutely the law. ARS 11-1051 makes that very, very clear. And, you know, I think what we're seeing here in some of this the attempted rhetoric from Republicans in the legislature and Republicans across the Arizona political spectrum is really trying to weaponize the ghost of SB 1070. And what Attorney General Mays is doing is really trying to focus on actual and real law enforcement tactics and these, you know, very, you know, headline grabby type ICE enforcement actions are not something that are going to be welcome here in Arizona, because it distracts from real law enforcement priorities. I mean, in the tenure of Attorney General Mays, she's stopped the movement of over 175 million pounds of fentanyl powder, which would save the lives of 40 million people in the country. So focusing on fentanyl, focusing on drug cartels is very different than non-criminal migrants. And, you know, if we can keep our focus there, I think that's going to be best for Arizona and best for the country.
Matt, how big of an issue do you think immigration is going to be playing in these midterm elections?
Big, and certainly bigger in the general election, I think. Mm. And look, I mean, border security is always a potent political issue in Arizona. And so I would caution Democrats who, you know, think, oh, that issue, we put that one behind us, it's just about the economy or gas prices or this or that. No, border security, immigration enforcement are and will always be big issues in Arizona. And I think Democrats have to be careful to be perceived as being obstructionist to immigration enforcement.
Sam, about 30 seconds left. Do you agree with that?
I agree in the sense that Attorney General Mays and the apparatus of Arizona's law enforcement is focused on border security. And I think those results are coming through. I think Arizona is safer because Chris Mays is Attorney General.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Sam Richard, Matthew Benson, thanks you both for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's all for this week's Friday Newscap. You can find the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening.